This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Brings together a collection of 16 people who he calls his nieces and nephews to teach them a lesson, to teach them to be better people, all in the context of this game where they're all competing for multi-million dollar grand prize, which is an inheritance.
So with that as a backdrop, tell me what made you decide to write a book about your family's experience and your son's experience and your stepson's experience with the school system?
I always wanted to write a book. That was a dream I've had since I was a young child. And actually, if I had my way, I'd be a children's author. And I think that if I write something else, I'm going to focus on that genre. I love children's novels. But in particular, there's an incident I describe in the book. My son, who is now in college, when he was in elementary school, he was a very anxious child. He was a lot like me, actually. And he started developing minor problems with school that just slowly escalated. He went to an excellent elementary school. It was a parent participation school in which I got to teach and write curriculum for a couple hours a week from when my son, kindergarten through fifth grade.
Now, had you ever done anything like that before?
I have never taught before. I never worked with children before. And I was just going on, quite frankly, raw talent and ability, because I remember what it was like to be a kid very vividly and what it was like to be mistreated by teachers and what impacts the best teachers had on me. And remembering that the teachers who were really awful and mean at the age of 43, I cannot remember for the life of me what any of those people taught me, that their attitudes far overshadowed the learning in the classroom. And so I kept that in mind when I was working with children. What kind of teacher did I want? So I was the teacher I wanted to be. When my son left this learning model, this parent participation, rah-rah community learning model, he started developing real problems. He had a sixth grade teacher who simply would not work with us. He had developing learning disabilities, and she was just angry that he wouldn't perform for her. She was very negative to him. We moved him to a private school, and the private school was fantastic for the first half of sixth grade. Then he got to seventh grade. He had immediate serious problems. He could not manage the freedom he had. Freedom is the wrong word. He was expected to manage his homework to a degree that he had never been able to before. What we did not know was that he had executive functioning problems. And when he got to the seventh grade, they had a project. They do an annual science fair every spring. And my son could not manage doing the project all by himself. And a week before the actual science fair, his teacher called me and said, you know, he hasn't done anything. I was furious. He'd been lying to me about the project. He'd been telling me that it had been coming along really well. And then suddenly I heard that he had done nothing. And the teacher asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, what if he just goes to the science fair with a blank board? And the teacher said, oh, thank God you said that, because so many parents would be ready to kill me right now. They'd be screaming about lawsuits. Natural consequences seem fair. Let's go with that. And in the days leading up to the science fair.
Right. And I wanted to say, you know, I can't imagine a parent allowing their children to go to a science fair with no project as a way to prove cause and effect consequences of their actions.
Well, I knew parents who absolutely abjectly refused to let their children fail. And one of the messages that we give children every single day in schools, because I was there, I was in schools, it's okay to fail, that we learn best from failing. And so I thought, well, okay, let's let him fail. He's going to learn something from this. And instead of actually, oh, he failed in a big way. The morning of the science fair, I woke up to this pounding noise, and I couldn't understand what it was. I got up. I walked past my son's room. My son's bedroom door was open and the room was empty, and I groggily wondered where my son was. And the pounding was somebody was knocking on the front door. I opened the front door, and my son had locked himself out of the apartment, and he limped in, and he told me that he had thrown himself down the stairs to avoid going to the science fair, and it was all my fault. And in fact, we spent the morning at a medical facility. What he did was we were on the second floor of a 3-floor apartment, and he had gone to the landing between the second and third floors. He had climbed over the railing and he had dropped himself down on the ground, and he only broke a tiny bone in his foot. He could have damaged a growth plate, which meant that he would have permanently disabled himself. He could have broken his neck, and instead he broke this tiny bone in his foot. And after we got it set in a cast, I said to him, "You're going to the science fair. You're going back to school right now. If I don't take you back to school, I'll reward you. And if I reward you, you will do this again. And you are never doing this again." So he went to the science fair that night with a blank board.
And a broken foot.
And a broken foot. And he told parent after parent after parent why he had a cast on his foot and why his board was blank. And that's what prompted my friend JD to say, "Wow, you should write a book." So that's the very long story to why I wrote a very long story, is that in 2006, when my son broke a bone in his foot, my friend JD just began to nag me and nag me and nag me about writing a book about school.
You also tell the story of your own experiences with school and your own experiences with family and their relationships with school. In fact, it seems that your description of your brother, his experiences with school very closely parallel some of the experiences with your son, such that you want to make sure that they are not identical experiences.
Yes. When my brother was an adult, we found out that he was bipolar. And bipolar can look like ADHD in children. And I think part of what made my brother tick is also that he's extremely extroverted. And I think bipolar can manifest very differently in extroverts and introverts. I'm an introvert with bipolar. I found out much, much later in life that I'm bipolar. But my brother had problems from the day he started school. He had self-control issues. He had attention issues. And in the 1970s, in Catholic school, this is a serious problem. So he became labeled as a problem child almost immediately. My parents spent his entire academic career fighting with educators over him. He acted out in classrooms because he wasn't getting what he needed. And when they begged schools to help them, they were told over and over again that my brother more or less didn't deserve an education. He didn't deserve a future. That was the message they were given over and over and over. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. My brother went on to become a heroin addict. He went on to get in a lot of trouble with the law. He was a dealer for a while. One of the last times in life that I've seen him, he had to leave the state he was living in for a couple days because a rival dealer was trying to kill him. So my brother had problems academically from the day he started school. I'm a little different. I was the family golden child initially. I was reading before I started school. I was very advanced in elementary school. I skipped the sixth grade. And it took me a long time to hit my head on a ceiling, basically. School was just too easy and too boring and too stupid, and I never had to bother working very hard. So I eventually tanked when I got to university. I went to the University of Virginia. Many mental illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar, mania, depression, these things start to manifest in puberty to people's early 20s. The onset of schizophrenia is usually 19 to 20. For me, I had trouble with depression starting at age 14, and I had my first manic episode at the University of Virginia.
I wanted to tell you, I mean, reading through your book, it seems that the storytelling is up and down. It seems like there are periods where you have these bursts of enthusiasm and optimism, and then just as quickly it seems to slide down into dourness and hopelessness, and then it's up again.
First of all, everybody's life tends to be a roller coaster, I think, but it also mimics the experience of being bipolar, which, for those who don't know, you go from extreme states, like you're really manic, you feel invincible, it's like you're on speed, basically, and then you can suffer from crushing depression. So your experience of yourself is extreme highs and extreme lows. There's a blogger, a bipolar blogger, Natasha Tracy, She's at natashatracy.com, and she also blogs for a number of other mental health gateways. And one of the points she makes about being manic is that you become another person. You become another person, and that you're so busy becoming another person that you can't see you're becoming another person, but your friends can. And they can't tell you that you're changing, that like it's hard to listen. And I become really outgoing. I become really pro-risk. I do crazy things. I would never, if I'm feeling calm, I would never put up a website, you know, or a YouTube video or whatever. So right. So I become more outgoing. I become a bigger risk taker. So part of it is being manic. But as I've grown older, I've grown to accept that I am very introverted and I do need a lot of quiet cave time. And the internet is an introvert's playground because it enables me the opportunity to be very social in a way that doesn't drain me personally. Because that's one of the things about being an introvert is that you find human interactions really just gut you. I don't know.
Okay. And in the writing of the book, I mean, I can see you were going through that, or was it just remembering that you were going through that when you were going through those experiences?
Well, I walked away from my children's school experiences with post-traumatic stress disorder as well. And I wanted, when I was writing the book, I wanted to portray the experience of having PTSD. The book is written in a first person, very intense first person perspective, present tense perspective. And I try to be as in the moment with each experience as possible. So I try to remain as true as possible to what was happening in the moment, just so to give readers a sense of how immediate these memories are. When I'm thinking about what went wrong at my stepson's school, it is happening in my head right this minute. So I think to answer your question, it's really the way it was in the moment, although it's true that writing the book itself had me bouncing up and down throughout the process.
When you were talking about the experiences that you had and you didn't really hit a ceiling until university, when I was reading the book, it seemed like the first ceiling you hit was when you were at that elementary school in France, because it seemed like you went from a big fish. You even said it yourself. You went from a big fish in a little pond to a little fish in a big pond, and it seems like your French classmates didn't really give you and your family a good time. You didn't have a good time there.
My father was an Internal Revenue Service, an IRS agent who specialized in Americans and American corporations overseas. So from third to fifth grade, my family lived in Paris, France. My dad worked at the embassy there. And we actually went to a Catholic school there run by American nuns. And school was mostly fantastic in France, but it was our first experience living overseas, and Americans were not super popular at this time. We had already been meddling in Middle Eastern affairs. While we were in France, the hostages in Iran were taken. So there was a strong anti-American undercurrent, and our neighbors in our Paris neighborhood actually took it out on us. And so that was my first real experience with hardcore bullying. And the tragedy of that is that my parents always happened to appear when we cracked and started fighting back with these kids. So what my parents saw was that we were aggressors and that we were creating problems when in fact we were being very badly bullied. And so my parents never ever believed that we were victims. The constant refrain was, well, obviously you did something to instigate it. And I think that's one of the themes of the book is about bullying and the impact that bullies can have on you as children and adults. It's pretty serious. It had a pretty serious impact on me. And then after 3 years in France, we went to Ottawa, Ontario, and then I was very, very badly bullied. I was the only American student at this middle school. I started school 2 weeks late because we moved late. I had been working well ahead of grade level at my school in France, and suddenly the school jumped me ahead to seventh grade, and my Canadian classmates were not thrilled. We're not thrilled that the Americans suddenly showed up and I guess made them feel stupid. I I did not want attention. I was the kind of kid who wanted to keep my head down and my nose clean, and I didn't want anybody. I was a very shy child, so the last thing I wanted was attention, and suddenly I had a lot of it just for skipping a grade right in front of them.
I wanted to make a connection between that experience that you had in school and the experience that you had teaching school, because I think it's interesting that you had a period when you were in school where you decided to sort of dumb yourself down. Because you were tired of being punished for being smart. But then when you were teaching school as an adult, you wanted credit for what you knew and for how you helped those kids in the school that you were volunteering at advance, but you weren't getting credit for that either. And I just wondered, I mean, did it ever sort of feel like, you know, I can't win here?
I went to graduate school for a while, and a friend of mine there, we talked about middle school a little bit and our middle school experiences, and he noted that when you get to middle school, it's cool to be intelligent in elementary school, and you get to middle school and puberty sets in and group dynamics change in tweens, and suddenly it becomes harder to be smart. It becomes uncool to be smart. And when my entire identity was bundled in being academically advanced at that point. And it is extremely common even now for girls particularly to dumb themselves down when they get to middle school and high school. Because there are consequences. There can be social consequences. And I think that when I got to be an adult, I wanted it to be clear that it is groovy to be intelligent, to celebrate that. And the school that my son attended, the elementary school my son attended, we talked a lot about Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, which is used in schools to think about the different ways that we can be intelligent. And so not only was I trying to celebrate being smart and intelligence in the kids that I taught, but also to examine the different ways that we can be intelligent. So maybe you're struggling in this subject over here, but that doesn't make you dumb. That just means that's your weakness, but you've got strength somewhere. So
now talk a little bit about that, because if my understanding of that is correct, it's like there are people who are intelligent because they draw their intelligence through tactile, and then there are people who draw their intelligence through visual, and there are other people who draw their intelligence through listening to instructions versus people who read instructions. Is that what you're talking about?
Somewhat. That's part of it. But how Gardner's theory in particular talks about kinesthetic intelligence. So people who can move their bodies really well, athletes and dancers, interpersonal intelligence. Extra personal intelligence. So how intelligent you are dealing with people, how intelligent you are about yourself, mathematical intelligence, logical thought intelligence. But part of it is how we internalize information. And it's a way of thinking about what kinds of teaching serves us best as individuals.
You had this tense of speaking, like when talking about how you will come to respect, this is when you were talking about your period in France, you talked about how you will come to respect your father for becoming a better listener. I was just trying to understand what tense that was, because you use a couple of different tenses when you spoke.
I kind of boxed myself into an authorial corner, actually, by focusing on the present tense. And there were times when I wanted to make editorial comments, but I did it in a way that indicates someday I'm going to get to a different place around this.
Right. That's what it sounded like.
Yes. Because the friend of mine who edited the book said, you know, there were times I just wanted to smack you. And when I was writing it, there were times when I thought, how could I have been so stupid about this organization, those people, the empty promises I heard? And I felt there were times when I just had to just say, you know what, eventually I'm going to figure it out.
And I want to go back to that, too. I mean, you are really angry at some of these organizations.
I am.
I mean, whether it's the counseling organization, whether it's the school district, whether it's, I mean, you really, and so I was thinking when I was reading this book, I was thinking, okay, is this a warning that she is writing for parents? Is it an archive of your own personal experience? I mean, or is it sort of like, I told you people I was going to come back and get you, and here it is.
Well, I told them I was going to write a book. I am angry. I am very angry. I worked my tail off for the Mountain View Wisman School District.
And that's something else. Now, in the book, you don't identify it, but in the interview now, you're identifying it.
Yes. In the book, I use aliases. The book is also about a Burning Man project here in Portland that I got involved with after I finally escaped Mountain View. And so for my own entertainment, I gave all these organizations and people aliases. I called Mountain View Wiseman School District Skull Crusher Mountain View. And
Skull Crusher, that's telling.
It's after a Jonathan Coulton song, Skull Crusher Mountain. It's about a crazy mad scientist. He's nuts. And I became crazy doing what I was doing for them. But for 10 to 12 years, I was a very loyal volunteer. I got involved with the Mountain View Educational Foundation. I designed their logo. I taught many kids. I ran a PTA fundraiser. I sat on a district committee. And I drank the Kool-Aid. I drank the Kool-Aid quite thoroughly. And all the district literature, over and over and over, we serve the needs of all children. We care about every child. If your child is struggling, we are going to do what it takes to get them what they need. And when my stepson, who was 7 years younger than my son, began kindergarten and began struggling, and part of it was because he had a mentally ill mother who was abusing him. And these people who'd been telling me for years that they care about every child dropped the ball on him. They didn't follow the law. They didn't deliver the service as promised. And what really frustrated me about that is that the rhetoric was on target, that when I saw people in the same school district organization get together, work together, and collaborate in the way they promised, they made magic for children, that they were able to solve problems for children quickly and early in their development. And watching people just evade and avoid their own values was infuriating and frustrating, and it was detrimental to the kid. It was detrimental to his classmates. It had a huge negative impact on the learning in the classrooms that he was in, and it was devastating. The consequences to my family were devastating.
But your focus to get them to follow their own rules was laser-like. I mean, you researched the rules and regulations and policies and laws, and then you put those in their face and said, this is who you say you are. This is what you're supposed to do. You are obligated to do it. Most times, most people let that kind of stuff slide because they think, I can't fight the system. I don't think those words ever crossed your mind.
When you have front row seats to the complete destruction of someone's life, the way I did with my brother. Just, my brother was a super bright guy. He was one of the funniest people I've ever met. Just really quick thinker. Not get what he needed in school, and to see him, to watch him become a heroin addict, to watch him try to kill himself over and over again, to watch him, you know, end up in jail, busted for DUIs, to watch these, to have front row seats to this because educators would not work together. There was absolutely no way I was going to allow this to happen to my stepson. Absolutely no way. I could not live with myself if I had just sat there and let the dysfunction slide, because I understood all too well what some of the potential consequences could have been to that child's future.
Well, I mean, just by the fact that you read The Westin Game, the fact that you researched police interrogation techniques, I mean, that tells me that you were very prepared to do whatever it took
yes.
to get people to follow their
yes.
own rules.
Well, the police interrogation techniques. As I said, my stepson's mother was mentally ill. We strongly think it's a borderline personality. She was untreated. She refused to get help. She was keeping the child out of school, which is, it's very common for borderline personalities, narcissistic mothers, to sabotage their children's educations. So That's what she was doing, and there was a time we got dragged into counseling with her, my husband and I, to talk to the child's mental health intern, and oh God, everybody knew that woman was crazy. Everybody knew she was being abusive to her child. Everybody knew it was emotional abuse. Everybody knew that she was sabotaging him, except the mental health professionals in the equation. And so we picked him up, we moved him to a different mental health facility, and when we all got dragged in to this meeting together, I was like, damn it, I am going to manipulate her to do what I want so that they can see what we're dealing with. So I went prepared. I thought we were going to be in a long-term counseling situation with her, but I looked up police interrogation techniques. How do you manipulate someone into giving you the information they want or to acting the way that you want in a high-stakes situation. That's the way I saw it.
And so in the end, I mean, as it turns out, things worked out pretty well because your stepson, his schooling and education became more stabilized. He became a much happier, healthier child.
It's a little more involved than that. He did become a happier person. My husband and I worked overtime. I've never seen a man work so hard on his parenting. My ex-husband became a much better father. And just having that emotional and psychological stability in the child's life made a huge difference. But actually, I got more ruthless than the police interrogation techniques. When my stepson's school finally said, you know, we put it in writing, you know, we know she's the problem and we're not going to do anything about it. His second grade teacher told me she was afraid that his anxiety could lead to depression someday.
Which might lead to suicide. That seemed to be a big trigger for you.
That was a huge trigger because my brother had tried to kill himself multiple times. My son had thrown himself down over the side of our building, and I just could not allow that to happen. Absolutely refused to happen. That's when I had the psychotic break. That's when I thought the universe was putting me on a mission to use the Westin game to fix his problems. And it turns out that the child's maternal grandmother is regional social services director for a Midwestern division of the Salvation Army. So she was a social services professional. She had been asked to help, and she had enabled her daughter's continuing academic abuse of her child. So I just snapped. I got it in my head that it was my job to threaten this woman with blackmail. And that was pretty much what finally did the trick when I brought down the hammer on the child's maternal grandmother and said, your daughter's acting like this. You need to do something about it. You need to leverage your professional experience and your contacts, and you need to deal with it.
Tell me about how Burning Man fits in with all this.
Things escalated to the point where I caught this school district's mental health contractor basically breaking the law. They are still illegally withholding my stepson's records, mental health records, from his father. And initially, they handed over 1 year after following the initial request. We went back to them and said, look, you didn't, you know, we know that he was seen there for 2 years. They initially told, well, you know, he wasn't our patient the second year, when in fact we had multiple witnesses, including a former intern for the organization, who told us that, yes, in fact, he was seen there. I brought this to the attention of the school district leadership, and two of them told me in email that their relationships with their mental health contractor were too delicate for them to enforce state and federal patients' rights laws, which was just absolutely outrageous to me. And then I actually had open complaints against a couple of personnel at the time. And I learned a few months later via the local paper, the Mountain View Voice, that when they were telling me their interpersonal relationships were too delicate for them to follow the law, a principal that I had an open complaint with was dating the school district superintendent. And they were able to manage that little sticky interpersonal problem just fine. They hired a lawyer to rearrange their chain of command so that these two could basically go steady while they were not providing any kind of oversight for their mental health contractor. So I didn't know what to do with this. I just could not quit fighting. And at some point I read that YouTube videos were all the rage in getting consumer complaints resolved. Bunch of Bank of America customers had made YouTube videos that actually lit a fire under the bank to change some policy. And so I made this YouTube video about the school district's ridiculous response to my concerns and brought it to the attention of the parents at my stepson's school. And they completely blew me off. But I was a raver in California, and I'd also been to Burning Man. And what the parents at that school didn't know was that I also asked a bunch of ravers and people who go to Burning Man for assistance, getting the word out about this injustice at the Mountain View Wisman School District. And the burners and ravers busted their butts to help me. They spread that link, the link to the YouTube video, around. They did everything they could to try to get me help and attention and support. Two of them accompanied me to a school board meeting And while the parents just completely blew me off. And again, the community is a very big buzzword in rave and Burning Man communities, and it was a very big buzzword at my stepson's school, the Ra-Ra Community School. And when the parents had an opportunity to exercise good community, they completely failed. They completely ignored me. And while, you know, the people who go into the woods and listen to electronic music and often take drugs, they actually were more invested in fairness and justice for children in Mountain View.
Your whole story is about reasonableness and how it's ignored. I mean, one of the questions I have is, how could anybody ignore reasonableness?
You know, if it's a microcosm, I think this school district in California is a microcosm of what's happening at the top levels of federal government. You have a collection of people who seem to have forgotten why they're in these positions in the first place and who they're supposed to be serving.
But most people don't have your kind of advocacy. So then, like you said, when you were at the school board meeting and you were trying to get other parents to buy into, because I'm assuming you aren't the only parent that had these kinds of issues regarding their children with the school district, with the counseling agency, but yet these other parents, they didn't go the extra mile. They didn't do that kind of work.
I think part of it's socially common. I think part of it's an outcome of the helicopter parent attitude. Everybody wants something to be everybody wants everything to be nice. Nobody wants to rock the boat. No one wants to be the one who says you're wrong. Or they can't necessarily believe, well, you know, this person's so nice, how could they possibly be totally destroying someone else's life? Or they just don't want to get involved. There's all kinds of reasons that people just don't want to get involved. I don't know. That's one of the problems with my story, and that's one of my frustrations with myself, is I just can't let it go, that other people seem to be able to walk through life and accept all manner of dysfunction around them, all manner of sacrifice of values for personal comfort. I found the whole thing frustrating, just having been really involved in a school. Every year they get all crazy for Martin Luther King Day and celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. and all his accomplishments. And obviously, they didn't really, you know, marching on Washington was not comfortable. Being fire hosed and arrested and attacked by dogs was not comfortable. It's like they can't make the connection between the effort and the outcome.
And it made me think of two other things. Like, you don't seem to have a lot of patience for anyone you seem to perceive to be below you intellectually.
No. And I think part of that is a function of, you know, when you're the rock star academic as a kid, that's something they instill in you pretty young, that being intellectual is superior. Mm-hmm. But it's this kind of narrow type of intellect. But I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, I'm angry. I'm not gonna deny it. I'm angry about a lot
or
of things that
happened.
Right. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And I think that, I mean, wouldn't if you this had happened to you, wouldn't you be mad?
Yes.
I mean, it being mad is really a reasonable response. So I clearly run out of patience for the people who kept telling me the same silly things over and over again. Well, we can't help because, you know, our hands are tied. It was just unbelievably frustrating.
Whether it was the council or whether it was your stepson's mom or whether it was the school district, it seemed like you could probably have a lot of patience for someone who was just not capable of getting it. But you had less patience for people who clearly could get it but chose not to.
Well, these people also had educations behind them that told them that mental illness needs to be, that it develops, that it needs to be dealt with as quickly as possible. I mean, we're talking about people who, some of these people have degrees in education from Stanford. And the book ends with an interview with a heavy metal musician who also goes to Burning Man, who's also a credentialed teacher in Portland. And he's pretty fresh out of school, and demonstrated to me that the problem is at school sites. The problem is at therapy organizations, that these people learn what they're supposed to, that they get the right foundations above knowledge about how to interact with people, how to solve their problems. But something seems to go awry at the school site or in the therapist's office, that they seem to check their educations at the door. And that I find that incredibly frustrating. If I know that you've got a PhD in education, I know that you've got extensive academic knowledge about how to serve the needs of the children that you're supposed to be putting first, that I find that absolutely aggravating, because those people aren't ignorant. They, in fact, did homework and wrote papers and wrote master's theses and doctorates, that they, in fact, had been immersed in this knowledge for years and years and years. So that makes me particularly angry. I wasn't telling them anything they shouldn't have already known.
You know, the thing about a novel like yours, would you call it a novel?
It's a creative nonfiction book.
The thing about this, I mean, a lot of times when you ask people, how much of this has to do with your own life? People say, well, there's elements of it about me, but it's not really about me, because they always want to keep that distance. You don't want to keep that distance. You want people to know this happened to me. And I just wondered, why are you completely revealing yourself like this?
We, as a country, we are in the middle of a national education crisis. Our college graduation rates are the lowest in first world countries. That we're getting our butts kicked academically by school systems all around the world, notably Finland. We know that Asian countries far excel in math over us. And our politicians keep coming up with what seem like really simplistic responses, like No Child Left Behind was George W. Bush's brainchild. And, you know, testing children to determine how good their teachers are. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book is to show how complicated it is. It is complicated that a child could be tanking academically because he's got a learning disability that's not being addressed. A child could be tanking academically because his parents are idiots or abusive. One of the biggest problems I saw at school sites was actually bad administrators, bad principals. So, you know, we're repeatedly punishing teachers over and over and over because of student test score outcome, when in fact it's complicated and there are so many things that could go wrong at a school site. I recently met another Portland teacher, and we talked about, you know, well, what would you do? What solutions would you institute? And it's so complicated. And we want to legislate these simple, easy solutions. If we get rid of the unions, we'll have better schools. If we, you know, test the hell out of our kids, we'll have better schools. If we change the curriculum, we'll have better schools. And what my book reveals is that anyone can be a problem at any time, and that the biggest problem in a child's life academically is the adult who won't collaborate, and that can be anyone. It could be the counselor, it could be the teacher, it could be the resource person, it could be the principal, it could be the parent.
Your ex-husband's wife, she homeschooled.
No, she wanted to homeschool. My ex-husband's wife, who we were eventually told, probably had a borderline personality by a licensed counselor. She had an undergraduate and graduate degrees in child development and desperately wanted to be a teacher. And she was a terrible parent. And here's an example of disconnect between the education and behavior. Academically, she demonstrated over and over that she understood that certain things were appropriate in child development, and yet she would just... She treated her toddler like an adult. She turned that kid into a huge brat. And she desperately wanted to homeschool him, which would have been an absolute disaster. He was falling behind in reading and writing, which were her favorite subjects, and excelling in my husband's favorites, which were math and science. Our theory is that she did not want that child in school because she didn't want to hear criticism of her parenting.
Well, the reason I bring that up is because, as you know, homeschooling has had a resurgence in the last decade or so. And a lot of people feel that the education system does suffer from a lot of the things you're talking about: bad educators, bad policy, bad administrators. And so people are sort of reverting to homeschooling, and they want to have more control over their child's education. So then what do you think about that? What do you think about homeschooling as a viable alternative to the problems that the public school system faces?
It depends who's doing it. My husband's ex-wife said homeschooling so many times that my husband and I we just never wanted to hear the term homeschooling ever again. But I do have friends who homeschool their children, and they're doing fantastic jobs of it. Homeschooling is tough. homeschooling is tough. Trying to wear the parenting hat and the teaching hat, because you're balancing multiple types of relationships with your child when you're homeschooling, finding the materials, knowing what materials to trust. But my friends who homeschool have done a fantastic job of figuring out what kind of learners their children are, which makes a huge difference, figuring out the best possible materials, because they're not slaves to anyone's district or state curriculum. They can pretty much find the best fit for their kids. And they're also very good at making sure their children are well socialized. One of my friends who homeschools, her daughters, the kids were all very involved, or are all very involved in gymnastics. So they always had teammates and friends. Like the friends I know who did it were very conscious of all the issues and are doing everything in their power to get their kids everything they need.
And your exposure has been across all kinds of available teaching. There's been homeschooling, there's been public school, and then private school. I mean, talk about private school a little bit, because you've also had lots of experience in private school.
Private school is not a guarantee. And I also have my son's elementary school was public but alternative. He went to another public elementary school for half a year. He ended up at a Montessori school, a K-8 Montessori school, and he finally landed in a charter school. So I have had experience with multiple formats, and they all had the same kinds of problems. I think that's one of the things I found interesting, even though it was frustrating at the time and I was ready to scream. They all had very similar problems. People who don't want to admit that the child's not thriving on their watch, people who don't want to do the self-examination that's required. And I think the thing about when that happens at private school, it's really super frustrating because it's a very expensive loss. When my son was at the private Montessori school, finally my ex-husband, his father and I started more or less homeschooling our child. My ex-husband was paying $18,000 a year so that we could buy books, we could buy materials, we could make sure the kid gets all his work done. And because it's a Montessori format, they don't allow parents in the classroom. They're very uptight about the kind of training people get when they're in a classroom. And I personally think that's a mistake. That's a mistake. I think if you're dealing with a school that doesn't want you in the classroom, that doesn't want their teachers' techniques and methods scrutinized in real time during learning instruction hours, run away. Because you can't have an honest intellectual discussion with the person who will not allow you anywhere on their turf. And I think that when you've got a child who's got special needs and learning problems, it is essential that you get a systemic response, that you get everybody to the table, that everybody can have an honest conversation, make a contribution. And the Montessori school's attitude was, well, you know, you're not trained, you don't get it, you don't understand, when in fact, they were the problem in my son's life.
A lot of parents are very passionate about their child's education while their children are school age. And then after their children get out of the school system, I mean, you can see this problem with school districts and revenue base, because parents who have had children in school and no longer have children in school don't want to have to pay for school taxes, because they don't want to pay property taxes and go to school, because they're saying, I don't have a kid in school anymore. Why do I have to pay the taxes for that? And I'm just wondering, I mean, do you think that parents need, or adults, society needs to get more involved in the welfare of the school system and the welfare of the children who become the next generation of community?
I think absolutely, because the social consequences of the kids who don't get the education to which they are legally entitled, that we're all paying for, the social consequences are huge. The other night I watched PBS Frontline episode about Adam Lanza, who shot the kids at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And sure enough, I predicted that child had special needs. And sure enough, absolutely, he had an IEP, an individual educational plan, from a young age. He had all sorts of learning problems. Now, I'm not saying learning problems create criminals. That's absolutely not true. And I'm not a criminal, even though I had learning problems late in life. But I've also seen in my brother's behavior, my brother cost taxpayers more money in the justice system because he became a junkie. He became a criminal. And we all paid for that. Everybody was paying taxes in the 80s and 90s, paid for my brother's problems. And so, you know, if we don't get children what they need, that they put a dent on systems as adults. You know, they become involved in social services programs. If they can't support themselves because they didn't get the education they were supposed to be getting in the first place. But, I mean, this isn't new. We already know. I mean, we already know from looking at kids in poor urban environments that their prospects, when they don't have good teachers, when they don't have good schools, when they don't have school supplies, when they don't have safe classrooms, when they don't have enough money for desks and textbooks, we already know that it's going to have a huge negative impact on their adult lives. Girls can get pregnant early. You know, if we want fewer welfare mothers, we should invest more money and time in schools. If we want fewer drug addicts, then they should have better prospects in schools, because what school dictates for the rest of our lives is huge. It's huge.
So what do you hope to accomplish with this? What do you want to see happen when this thing hits the ebook reader?
Well, one of the questions I want people to ask themselves is what is crazy? What does it mean to be crazy? What's crazier, having a degree in education and then abusing your child and taking all that knowledge and throwing it out the window and mistreating your child? You know, what's crazy? I don't know. I would like people's eyes to be opened to the impact of the special needs child on their classrooms, for parents to realize that the child, even if your kid's doing fine in class, that child is sucking up resources, that child is sucking up the teacher's time, that child is draining resources from your and impacting the education on the people around them. I would like people to be aware that the lack of due process in schools actually allows us to continue down a very destructive, negative path nationally. Like I've said, we have the lowest college graduation rates in the third of first world countries. I would like people's eyes to be open to how few consequences there are for adults in our education systems, and that it is a very complicated system and situation, and that we can't just keep punishing teachers, or we can't just keep threatening to yank the unions, that we should all be thinking about ourselves in more broader terms, as adults, and how we behave and how we respond to the rules and what our real values are. And ideally, I mean, if I absolutely had to make a wish list, I would mandate school counselors for every school. That's not true. Elementary schools are not required to have school counselors when we know, and there's the research is out there, when we know that the sooner we deal with kids' problems, the better off that child's going to be, the better off the school community is going to be, the less impact that child's going to have on resources later in schools and in life. But if I could make my wish list, and what would I wave my wand and turn things into law, I would definitely come up with ways to examine administrator behavior, examine leadership behavior, and take a good look at, you know, whether or not policies are being made actually to serve children. And Michelle Rhee is a controversial figure, and I don't really, I approve of where she's coming from in that adults do a lot of self-serving things in schools on taxpayer dime. I don't agree with her methods in dealing with them, but she is a leading national voice who's talking about how adults just do whatever they want with no consequence, and how unfair it is, and how it wastes money and wastes resources and wastes time and wastes futures.
So this book took a lot out of you?
It did. I spent, like I said, I'm bipolar, and I was in a manic state the entire time that I wrote it. I recently finished. I crashed. I crashed into a depressive phase. I was running on absolute pure mania to complete the book, to write the book, to think about the book.
Right. Well, for people who suffer from the same manic and depressive swings that you do, at least they know that if there's a project that they have on hold, there's no reason they have to keep it on hold. They can get it done. They can do it because you did it.
Well, when I learned that I was bipolar in late 2011, And one of the things that people say about being bipolar, it's like it's fun half the time. I mean, mania is a high. Mania is a high. It can be a very productive state if you've got something going on. And fixation is bundled in with mania. And that really helped me write a book because I was just so driven to. Mania can be very useful, but it's also very destructive. I describe how in a manic state I got involved with a man while I was married, believing that once again I was on a mission from the universe. It is not uncommon for people to have affairs when they are manic. It is not uncommon for people to spend a lot of money they don't have. So it can be extraordinarily destructive if you don't have something productive to put your energy into.
Right. And I mean, anybody who would know that, who reads the book and sees your own personal travails, they would probably wonder, well, Your Honor, this is not a credible witness. Because it's like, you know, it's like how do we believe and depend on her story when we can see personally she's kind of flaky.
That's true. And I was thinking about this earlier. One of the things that I mean, I end up in having this. I destroyed my marriage after I busted my butt for my stepson to fix our lives and get my husband's ex-wife under control. I ultimately destroyed our marriage by getting involved with a man during a manic episode and believing that, you know, I had trained my entire life to be with him and he was my destiny, when really I was in a profound manic state and I saw something shiny and I went for it. But the point that I make in the book is that, well, you know, everybody else has been lying, so now it's my turn. And I think one of the things that does is it demonstrates when you are living in a state of dysfunction for so long, it's hard to hold on to your values. You mentioned that I feel very strongly about my values, but they went to hell eventually too. Because I just surrounded by people doing whatever they want and finally found a compelling reason to do whatever the hell I wanted. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's really important that adults act like adults, because we can drag each other down. So no, I mean, I'm by far a perfect human being. I have made many mistakes. I've done a lot of stupid things. I've blown up my life so many times. It's ridiculous. And for being a credible witness, well, I wouldn't have written the book unless I actually could prove every word of it. Right. I actually have a stash of documentation. People left trails. And so, I mean, I may not be the most likable witness and I may not be the nicest person, but, you know, I can prove myself in a court of law, which is all that really mattered to me, because it enabled me to write the book I wanted to write.
And speaking of that, do you have any other books, or are you not going to run for the hills now?
I gotta deal with the one book. It like you said, I mean, it actually did take a lot out of me, and I'm looking forward to having conversations with people about it, not just in front of microphones, but to get people's experiences and find out what their stories are. Because, you know, when I told people, well, I'm writing a book about education and Burning Man, and people would tell me all their stories, and so I'm not alone. All kinds of people have been crapped on by their teachers or not got what they need from schools, or, you know, their educations didn't actually prepare them for real life. So I think everyone has a school story. Mine just happens to be really extreme and intense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ren, I really enjoyed this conversation. And tell me the name of your book again.
It's called A Very Long Story About Karma That Will Probably Make Me Cry. I wrote it. I'm Ren Green. I co-anchor the news here on KABU as Ren Green, but I wrote it as Renster, which is my Burning Man name. And you can get information on buying the book at my website, baconpirates.com, which is exactly what it sounds like, baconpirates.com.
All right, Ren, thanks a lot. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Don.
I'm Don Merrill. Thanks for listening.
Yogathon is here and KABU is a co-sponsor. Living Yoga is holding its fourth annual Yogathon during the months of April and May. Individuals and groups are creating their own personal yoga challenges. They're attending classes at several participating yoga studios in the Portland area, and friends and family are sponsoring their efforts. Living Yoga is awarding prizes to the top individual and team. All of this is to help benefit Living Yoga, a nonprofit program bringing yoga to people in drug and alcohol recovery, incarceration, or who are accessing community transitional services. More information about this six-week-long event can be found at living-yoga.org.
KABU is co-sponsoring a benefit to help save the Pioneer Mothers Memorial Cabin in St. Paul, Oregon. This historic building has been badly affected by past flooding and continuing erosion. There is an event happening on Saturday, April 27th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Newell House Museum in St. Paul, Oregon. The event includes an art exhibit featuring local artists, a juried art auction, historical tours, plus music, appetizers, and wine. More information about the Newell House Museum's Art for Education, Saving the Pioneer Mothers Memorial Cabin, can be found online at the KABU Community Radio Events page at kboo.fm.
KABU is a proud media sponsor of the 23rd annual Reach the Beach, scheduled for Saturday, May 18th. With the finish line in Pacific City, Reach the Beach offers four different starting locations. You can ride 100 miles from Portland, 80 from Newburgh, 55 from Amity, or 28 miles from Grand Ronde. More information on deadlines and registration for Reach the Beach can be found on our website at kboo.fm.
This is KABU News at Noon for Friday, April 26th. I'm Kristen Yount. Obamacare is awesome, according to a new study by the Commonwealth Fund published today. The Affordable Care Act has made it possible for 3.4 million younger Americans to acquire health coverage because they can stay on their parents' insurance until they are 26 years old. President Obama spoke in front of an abortion rights group today and vowed to join the fight for Planned Parenthood. The president acknowledged Planned Parenthood's almost 100-year legacy serving women. He also recognized that there is an agenda in the U.S. to undermine women's reproductive rights, and the consequence of attacks on Planned Parenthood adversely affects the general health of women because they provide life-saving cancer screenings. The president wants the Affordable Care Act to give more people more discretion when making their health care decisions. Senator Coons from Delaware launched the Master Limited Partner Parity Act yesterday. The bill gives clean energy producers the ability to trade publicly and would exempt them from paying corporate taxes, just like fossil fuel developers. The taxes would be levied on shareholders as income tax because they are the ones who receive dividends and therefore benefit in the increase in revenues. The bill has eight bipartisan co-sponsors and is considered a huge win for the clean energy sector. The new policy highlights transparency and is likely to attract foreign investors. Charlie Hales is going to deliver his first State of the City address today at the Governor Hotel. Talking points should include the three priorities that has been his rally since taking office this year: the budget, schools, and the police department. The city budget is due next week, and Portland is facing a minimum $21 million shortfall because of decreasing revenue. Historically, the city of Portland bolsters the state school budget and is unable to do that this year. Portland Police Bureau has been under fire for its use of deadly force against mentally diminished citizens, and most recently an officer was found guilty of child pornography charges and will do 5 years. Mayor Hales is expected to address how to aid a change in the culture of the Portland Police Department. The weather in Portland now is fantastic for the end of April. We are looking at gentle breezes, highs in the 70s, and no rain. Thanks for listening to the KABU News at Noon. I'm Kristen Yount. To get more volunteer-generated news, turn in here Monday through Friday for the latest in local, national, and international news. Be good to your bus driver.
And you're listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-sponsored community radio. I'm Lori Sonnenfeld. This is Moving On, and I'll be with you today playing folk music like we do every Friday. And we're always on from noon to 1:30 with folk music. I alternate with Don Jacobson. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting the Milk Carton Kids with the Barefoot Movement, Wednesday, May 15th at 8 p.m. Tickets and information for the Milk Carton Kids at the Aladdin box office and aladdin-theater.com. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Edgefield Concerts, presenting Rodrigo y Gabriela, Michael Franti with Spearhead, and The Flaming Lips this summer. Tickets for Rodrigo y Gabriela, Michael Franti, and The Flaming Lips on sale now at edgefieldconcerts.com. And I'm excited about our show today. We have an amazing array of musicians. In fact, we have two sets of live music today. First, we're going to be hearing from Peter Wilson, Mountain John Hilligoss, and Mo Dixon. And they're performing in town this weekend and all around the area. And so we're going to actually go to their new CD, Troubadour Camp, here in a moment. And then at about 12:45, Joanne Rand will be here. And she's debuting her new CD, and she has a concert tonight as well. So looking forward to lots of live music here today. And here's Troubadour Camp.